Welcome to The Book Show with me, Sinead Gleeson. As the winter solstice is upon us and Christmas is just a couple of days away, we thought it a good time to huddle in closer and talk ghost stories. On this evening's show, chilling stories from the world's best writers of the genre.
We're looking at the mummified corpses of four anonymous Dubliners.
We'll explore the work of M.R. James and how Daphne du Maurier's writing has been adapted for film.
Beguiling, that's the word I'd use about her writing. There's a sense of foreboding, but you don't know what's going to happen.
Get in touch by email bookshow@rte.ie or find us on Twitter and Facebook at bookshowrte. But first this evening, let's talk to two living writers. John Boyne is the author of The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas and most recently This House is Haunted, a novel-length ghost story. Joining us from London is Kate Moss, author of Labyrinth and co-founder of the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction, which was formerly the Orange Prize. Most recently, she's the author of The Mistletoe Bride and other haunting tales. Just to set the tone for us, Kate, we're going to hear a piece from The Mistletoe Bride, read here by Amy Hughes. This is where the titular bride fears her new husband, Lowell, will never find her.
The weeks turned to months, the months to years. Lovell lost hope. He took to wandering the roads and the pathways through the woods, crying my name, and I wept to see him so broken. Inside my tomb, my body grew thin, and in time faded quite away. All that was left were bones wrapped in tulle and silk, resting on a bed of blue cotton. Knowing I would have no peace until I was laid in the ground, I despaired that I would never be found, that I would be condemned to this half-existence for all time.
Kate Moss, there's certainly a chill hearing that read, but do you remember the first time you were scared yourself by reading a story?
Well, I think it might even have been that story, actually. My wonderful parents had a book called the Reader's Digest Book of Folklore, Myths and Legends of Great Britain. And it had all these creepy stories from every old house, every sort of strange, desecrated church, every wood, every hill. And I would sit there in the 70s, all curled up in a chair, reading all these ghastly stories and really scaring myself witless. And The Mistletoe Bride was one of those stories I first came across in my parents' book all those years ago, you know, 30, 40 years ago now. And I remember that, you know, what Edith Wharton calls the thrill of the shudder, the idea that you're safe and therefore it's okay to scare yourself. And that book was it for me, this 1973 book of Reader's Digest Myths.
John, there's definitely a physical and psychological effect, as Kate says there, that shudder. Why do we like to be scared? And is a ghost story maybe a safe way to feel a little bit terrified for a while and then jump back out?
Yeah, I think it's about living vicariously, isn't it? It's like being on a roller coaster, that you know on the roller coaster it's going to be thrilling, but you're probably not going to die. And in the ghost story, you know you're going to be unsettled, or you hope you are, if the story's written correctly, and you're going to be frightened. But at the end of the day, you can close the book and life will go on.
Do you remember being scared by something that you read when you were young?
Yeah, I remember reading A Christmas Carol for the first time when I was about 11. And I kept reading it every Christmas for 4 or 5 years. I always got a great thrill out of that. And I always, you know, the way they do the production of that in the Gate Theatre almost every year. And I've gone to it several times. There's something about A Christmas Carol and the ghosts of Christmas past and present and yet to come that still kind of frightens me.
Obviously, you've mentioned Charles Dickens there, but let's talk a little about some of the greatest ghost story writers, people like M.R. James or Sheridan Le Fanu, Dickens, Poe. Who do you think does it well, Kate Moss? Who are your particular favourites of you know, people who do it brilliantly, I think?
Well, all of those people, absolutely. But I think the Edith Wharton. Edith Wharton is seen as, you know, obviously she's the first woman to have won the Pulitzer Prize. She's seen as a wonderful literary writer, and absolutely she is. But she wrote many, many ghost stories. And what she does is has that wonderful sense of the normal world decaying, that it all seems completely fine on the surface, but yet there's that little shadow just in the corner, or when you lift the tablecloth, you see that the table is made of bones rather than wood. So for my money, she's absolutely up there with James, yes, with Poe, who is possibly more of a horror writer. I love Algernon Blackwood as well. He was an animist, and his stories are all out of nature, if you like, nature with a capital N. And I write stories that are very much inspired by landscape and nature and what happens when nature goes to the bad, if you like. And so I think Blackwood, again, is one of those, sometimes the overlooked master of the Edwardian ghost story.
I mean, the story that I like the best is The Signal Man by Dickens, which...
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, I love that one. And the sense of terror in that, of foreboding, yeah, and of somebody who's actually in fear of their lives is extraordinary. And I think he published that in All the Year Round in the 1860s. And that kind of storytelling, that's not so well known. You know, people don't really know those stories quite so well. And Dickens really doesn't have that. He's not as well known, really, I think, as a ghost story writer. But, no, you know, he had quite a lot over the years. And also, of course, the great thing about him was that he was such a great performer of his own work that people used to faint when he would, you know, read his ghost stories in public. And some writers are great at that. Some writers are great readers of their work and can really be an actor or an actress on stage. And some aren't so good.
Well, you mentioned...
I love reading my own stories, actually. That's one of the joys of having a collection of ghost stories, that I've been going around, rather than just talking about writing, I've actually been reading. And it's so different, actually, doing that, sort of watching people's faces as their eyes go bigger and bigger. And it's a completely different sort of relationship with your reader from the one that you normally have, exactly as you say, John.
Yeah, and a different relationship with the text as well, because I tend to... I don't know about you, Kate, but I actually read my work aloud at home when I'm writing it, to see how, you know, the rhythm of the sentences and how it's working. And I always think that's quite a good, useful
thing to
do.
Well, you can imagine, normally my books are so incredibly long that, well, you know, it would be, it's a different sort of thing. And for me, the joy of doing my first collection of short stories has been that intimacy between, as you say, me and the text, and then the text and the reader, who becomes a listener instead. And so it's been I feel exactly as you said about Dickens, that sense of performance. I haven't really had that before. And I realise that's given me a completely different sort of feeling about what it means to be a writer. And I feel really energised by it, actually, even though I'm writing really creepy stuff where, you know, people should feel that they can feel my finger going down their spine when they're listening.
Well, I think when you talk about that very visual and very aural aspect of the ghost story, M.R. James, every Christmas, used to gather a small select group of people into his office and read them a terrifying ghost story. Mm. Zoe Cummins went to speak to Daryl Jones of Trinity College in Dublin about M.R. James' work.
Almost 120 years ago, M.R. James came to Dublin. He made a stop in St. Michael's Church. Well, deep underneath the church, in the crypt.
I'm just ducking my head going down here into the crypt.
As if straight out of an M.R. James story, the entrance to the dusty cavern comes complete with creaking metal hinges and clanking chains. Dr. Daryl Jones from Trinity College Dublin is with me underground.
Yeah, well, you're in the crypt, all right.
Yeah. My goodness.
The hands are amazing, especially these two guys here.
The detail is extraordinary.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
This crypt holds an unsettling display.
We're looking at the mummified corpses, the mummified remains of four anonymous Dubliners. No one's quite sure how old they are, but we know that they're preserved because they stood on what used to be a marshy forest, and the high tannin content in the soil has preserved them and mummified them.
History and death pressing against the main characters in his stories has a lot to do with James's own professional interests and research.
He was drawn here because of his interest in the ghoulish and the supernatural, but also because he was a manuscript scholar, an antiquarian, and a church historian.
References to what he saw in the crypt crop up in his personal letters and a particular ghost story, Lost Hearts.
The moon was shining through the window, and he was gazing at a figure which lay in the bath. His description of what he saw reminds me of what I once beheld myself in the famous vaults of St. Michael's Church in Dublin, which possesses the horrid property of preserving corpses from decay for centuries.
He described these crypts in which we're standing now as like being in a nightmare. The corpses themselves were a horror.
A figure, inexpressibly thin and pathetic, of a dusty leaden colour, enveloped in a shroud-like garment, the thin lips crooked in a faint and dreadful smile, the hands pressed tightly over the region of the heart. As he looked upon it, a distant, almost inaudible moan seemed to issue from its lips, and the arms began to stir.
James really knew how to set the mood and build expectation for his stories when he first told them.
He read his stories to his pupils and his colleagues. It was a Christmas ritual on Christmas Eve, after dinner at high table in the hall of King's College. Certain select people would process across the college green to the provost's lodge, where near midnight he would emerge from his rooms and ceremonially blow out all the candles but one and sit down and read his latest ghost story. And this routine went on for several years, and it's the origin. That's how many of his stories, and certainly many of his early stories, that's how they first started. They were Christmas entertainments.
It was of bronze, he now saw, and was shaped very much after the manner of the modern dog whistle. Why, surely there were marks on it, not merely marks, but letters.
You know, the nights are at their longest. We huddle around the fire. We know that the forces of darkness are around us at their strongest, and we tell one another ghost stories in order to ward them off.
I ought to be able to make it out, he thought. The long one does seem simple enough. It ought to mean, who is this who is coming? Well, the best way to find out is evidently to whistle for him.
The power and danger of knowledge in books reoccurs as a theme in James's work.
For a man for whom knowledge was his business and his life, to write these stories warning against the dangers of forbidden knowledge is something that people have often found quite interesting and perhaps quite contradictory. But I think the lesson of this is that the books, that writing can be dangerous. We open books at our cost, and the cost is often great because you never know what's going to be in there. You never know what you're going to find.
Indeed, you never know what you're going to find in a book. Zoe Cummins reporting there. Still in studio with me is writer John Boyne, and Kate Moss is with us from London. We're talking about ghost stories. Kate, we've been focusing on M.R. James and a lot of the sort of sepia-tinted 19th century writers, but who do you think are the best modern writers of the genre?
Well, it's very interesting to decide what is a ghost story and what is horror. I think there was a period of time, certainly in the 60s and 70s, where the ghost story was seen as slightly old-fashioned, a little bit too cosy. Possibly for some people, the idea that it was far too much within a Christian tradition and it didn't seem modern. And so horror sort of took over and ghost story writers sort of stepped back. But I think for my money, the best of the proper ghost story writers that's around at the moment is Susan Hill. I think she has precisely that ability to set up a landscape that looks odd on the surface when you realise that there's a much deeper story going on behind it, the sense that you never overdo it, the idea that you never explain really what has happened or not, and that's the key of a good ghost story. I would say, you know, The Ghost in the Mirror is one of her great ones. And it's that sort of sense of atmosphere, of a narrative that drives forward, that is a proper story. It's not just horrifying. There's not just a load of bones or people with big teeth or people are going to be disemboweled. It's much more subtle than a lot of horror is. So Susan Hill, if you want to start, go for her.
You mentioned something they're seeing as quite old-fashioned, and John, Darrell Jones says in the introduction to his recent new collection of M.R. James stories that ghost stories need to be set a generation in the past, but then again that makes them quite old-fashioned. But do they have to be that far in the past? Is there nobody kind of doing it in modern terms?
No, I don't think so, because the firstly, you know, as somebody who's written a number of novels set in the past, it doesn't make them old-fashioned. You can still explore contemporary themes, contemporary issues and concerns in a novel set in the past. Sarah Waters' novel, The Little Stranger, which is a very fine ghost story. If I remember correctly, that was set around the 1920s or so, which isn't that far away, so it's not in the sort of Victorian era. But I think one thing that's helpful about the Victorian era for ghost stories is there's no electricity.
You know, exactly, just, no text light.
Yeah, and you know, you do get the opportunity to have people wandering around with candles and, you know, people in nightgowns holding candles, and it just lends a much more chilling atmosphere to things. But you know, the notion that you can't write about contemporary concerns in the past is false, really.
I found when I was writing my collection of short stories, Mistletoe Bride, that I didn't expect to, but many of the stories were set, I found, in the 50s and 60s. And it was a sense, I think, it's of an innocence and a not being connected with the world on a 24-hour basis. That's the only issue. That if you can simply dial your mobile phone, then a lot of the fear of being trapped on your own or not understanding has gone. So I agree entirely with John. It's not that it's got to be the distant past. It's just that there are certain requirements for something to be about isolation or about what's happening inside your own head that can somehow be tripped up often by the very contemporary modern world.
John, tell me about where you set your book, This House is Haunted, and maybe you'd give us a bit of a flavour of that book.
Well, I set it in Norfolk, which is... I was a student in Norwich many years ago and taught there, so it's a place I know quite well, and it's set in the 1860s. So this paragraph comes from quite early on. It's got a female narrator, which is the first time I've tried that. I closed my eyes and sighed, stretching out my body, my legs digging down deeper under the covers, and I expected that at any moment my toes would touch the wooden bedstead, but they did not, and I smiled to realise that the bed was longer than I was, that I could stretch out as much as I wanted, and I did so, pleased to feel my aching limbs loosen up as they reached as far as they could, the toes dancing beneath the sheets, a sensation of the most delightful pleasure. Until a pair of hands grabbed both my ankles tightly, the fingers pressing sharply against the bone as they pulled me down into the bed, and I gasped, dragging myself back up quickly, wondering what kind of terrible nightmare I'd fallen into. Throwing myself from the bed, I pulled the curtain across and ripped the bedspread away, but there was nothing there. I stood, my heart pounding. I had not imagined it. Two hands had gripped my ankles and pulled me. I could feel them still. I stared in disbelief, but before I could gather my thoughts, the door flew open and a sharp light filled the corridor, a white, ghost-like figure standing before me, Isabella.
And that was John Boyne reading from This House is Haunted. And you touched on some of the essential elements of the ghost story there. But for both of you as writers, is it, if you're tackling this genre, is it the lonely setting? Is it a specific atmosphere? Is it a child character? What must a great ghost story have?
I think it needs to have, like any novel, a reason for existing in the first place. That when I was writing mine, I knew I wanted to write a ghost story, but I didn't want to write one until I had a good reason for a ghost to exist. And that in itself, if a reader comes to the book, I think there's a definite theme there. There's a message that I am trying to explore about parenthood, about abandonment. It's not just to scare people. You know, every novel needs to have something deeper behind it.
What about you, Kate? Because you had a chance to have multiple stories because yours is a collection of short stories.
I think a ghost story is about a moment, not about creating an entire world, a cast of characters, that sort of, very heavily researched big piece of writing. It's about capturing a moment of grief, a moment of loss, redemption, fear, guilt. So when I was writing The Mistletoe Bride, some of them are inspired by folk tales, really ancient folk tales of ancient woods and landscapes. And others are precisely about that in this sort of more Edgar Allan Poe way, if you like. The Telltale Heart is a story about guilt and bad conscience in the end. So that, for me, was incredibly liberating, that I wasn't trying to do anything more than, if people pick up The Mistletoe Bride, making them sort of slightly shudder when they finish the story. So for me, they are entertainments. And that's how I hope people will read them. Whereas my bigger fiction, if you like, has a different sort of purpose. So, it's interesting. It's the opposite to John, but I'm off to buy John's book the minute we finish this interview because it sounds fantastic.
Well, if I can pit you against each other just for a moment to ask, see, John's book is a novel. Kate's new collection is short stories. Is the ghost story more suited to the shorter form just in terms of sustaining mystery and suspense? Is it harder to do over the course of a novel?
I'm not sure. I think it's quite a challenge to well done to Kate to write a whole whole short story collection about this. You need an incredible imagination to come up with that many ideas. I really focus on the novel, I think.
Kate?
I'm not a short story writer in any other form, but for me, yes, I think there are wonderful novels with ghosts in them. But I think it's the one form of literature for me, that belongs short. And I think the great ones, whether it's Henry James's Turn of the Screw, the Susan Hills that I mentioned, these are very short novels. Some would say a long short story. So I like the idea of writing in a small and self-contained way and then letting myself loose on big novels that are history rather than ghost stories. And I think it takes an enormous skill to sustain a ghost story over many, many pages, precisely because the closer you get to the ghost, the closer you get to the explanation, the harder it is to keep that level of tension and fear, if you will, the turn of the screw, at that sustained level. And so I think it's easier for me to write lots of short stories with lots of different protagonists than it would be to sustain a whole novel.
Well, we've talked about the fact that they have been seen as old-fashioned and yet they're still being written. But so why do you both feel that the ghost story continues to endure and be adapted? I mean, the BBC are going to show a couple of M.R. James stories over at Christmas. Why did they endure? Why do we still gravitate towards them?
Well, they are great for television and film because, you know, in the dark, particularly in the cinema, I remember seeing The Others, you know, that Nicole Kidman movie, and being, you know, I was 35 years old and being scared out of my wits in a New York cinema by it. But they're great for that because the atmosphere, just the visual sense of them, that's exactly what you're looking for from that.
I was just going to say it's exactly what your other guest down in the Dublin underground was saying, is that I think that we still are attracted to the idea that there are things that we do not know and we cannot explain. And even in these days of enormous science and technologies and somehow everything can be unpicked and explained and put back together, we all know that at 3 o'clock in the morning, it doesn't matter how logical, clever, informed you are, we've all had that moment where you wake up with your heart thumping and you're sure that there's something out there.
My thanks to John Boyne and to Kate Moss. John Boyne's This House is Haunted is published by Doubleday, and The Mistletoe Bride and Other Haunting Tales by Kate Moss is published by Orion Books. Now, staying on a spectral theme, two words that often send fear into the hearts of book lovers everywhere are film adaptation. But this year sees the anniversaries of three stories that were turned into three classic films. Daphne du Maurier's gothic romance, Rebecca, celebrates its 75th anniversary this year. And the film adaptations of her short stories, Don't Look Now and The Birds, are 40 and 50 years old, respectively. But what is it about du Maurier's writing that translates so well to the big screen? Liam Geraghty has been finding out.
Last night I dreamt I went to Manderley again. It seemed to me I stood by the iron gate leading to the drive, and for a while I could not enter, for the way was barred to me.
Since its publication 75 years ago, Daphne du Maurier's novel Rebecca has kept readers turning the page. It's the story of a young woman who falls in love with a man still troubled by the death of his first wife. Author Anna Carey read it first as a teenager.
All the key elements of her style are there. It's the Cornish setting, the slight air of dread and unease and something being wrong, but you not quite being able to put your finger on it. A lot of ambiguity and tension.
Rebecca was also filmmaker Stephen Benedict's first introduction to du Maurier's writing.
What I found fascinating about the book was that although I was a young man, I very closely identified the woman because the writing is so specific. It's so energetic and it really, really draws you in. So although I was very aware that I was reading about a woman's memoir, if you want, you're completely caught up in her enthusiasm, her naivety, her curiosity. It thrilled me in a way to discover that you could identify so closely with a person beyond your own gender. And that's a trick of du Maurier's writing, is she gets you right in there.
Alfred Hitchcock, who had already adapted du Maurier's book Jamaica Inn to the big screen, was tasked with directing the film version of Rebecca, starring Joan Fontaine, who died earlier this week.
What he was famous now for was taking books or short stories or published articles in magazines and completely radicalizing them and turning them into his film.
The shy, unsophisticated young girl who dared to follow in the footsteps of the beautiful Rebecca is portrayed by lovely Joan Fontaine.
I think Joan Fontaine is very well cast.
How could I ask you to love me when I knew you loved Rebecca still?
And that's the thing we've got to understand about books, is that when we're reading them, we are actually directing a movie ourselves. And we are casting it perfectly ourselves. There's no such thing as a bad performance in a book.
Do you think the dead come back and watch the living?
John, do you hear what I say? It was Christine.
My daughter is dead, Laura. She does not come peeping with messages back from behind the grave.
Yes.
Christine is dead.
Yes.
She is dead.
Don't Look Now is a classic cinematic thriller celebrating its 40th anniversary and was adapted from Du Maurier's short story of the same name.
Beguiling, that's the word I'll use about her writing for Don't Look Now. There's a sense of foreboding, but you don't know what's going to happen, and you fear what's going to happen, and yet you keep on reading because you want to see whether you're right or wrong. And the thing is, that's the trick of, I think that's the primary trick of writing, is to get the, obviously to get the reader to turn the page. And the way you get the reader to turn the page is you get them to project their expectation of what's going to happen. So they want to find out whether they're right. And that's what Du Maurier did in spades.
Hitchcock's third and final Du Maurier adaptation was The Birds in 1963.
Birds was a typical example where man takes nature for granted. What happens when it turns on him? So that is a question of a probing of nature, or the treating of nature, how should we say, casually, like birds are shot at, they're caged, you know. I don't know whether Miss Du Maurier had that in mind, but the thought did occur to me.
The hero, towards the start of the book, there's children, birds get into his children's room, and it's pitch dark, and it's at night, they don't have electricity, because it's like 1951 in the middle of the Cornish countryside, and he just goes in with a blanket, and there's this nightmarish scene where he's trying to beat all the, away all the birds.
He felt the thud of bodies, heard the fluttering of wings, but they were not yet defeated, for again and again they returned to the assault, jabbing his hands, his head, the little stabbing beaks sharp as pointed forks. The blanket became a weapon of defence. He wound it about his head and then, in greater darkness, beat at the birds with his bare hands. He dared not stumble to the door and open it, lest in doing so the birds should follow him.
When light arrives, he just sees that there's like 50 little robins and blue tits and sparrows, and that's all it was. There were just these tiny little birds. She's incredibly good at the sort of little details that chill the blood. There's a bit in Kiss Me Again, Stranger, where the girl, while they're on a bus on the way out of town, and she asks the boy to wake her when they get past the cemetery at the bottom of the hill. And that's where she needs to get off. And he says, "We haven't passed a cemetery as far as I know. Does it matter very much?" "Oh, there'll be others," she said. "I'm not particular."
And thanks to Liam Geraghty there for that report. That's all we have time for. You can find The Book Show on rte.ie and on Twitter and Facebook at BookshowRTE. The series is produced by Zoe Cummins and on sound with Sheila Niveril. We leave you this evening with Regan Hutchins and a footnote.
Are you concerned about your drinking? You can't quit the cigarettes? Not to worry, you're in good company. Many writers develop profound addictions. Mark Twain smoked over 40 cigars a day. Voltaire was addicted to cups of tea and coffee. But spare a thought for Tennessee Williams, the celebrated author of plays such as A Streetcar Named Desire and Cat in the Hot Tin Roof, was addicted to just about everything. Uppers, downers, tobacco, sex, and it all caught up with him. He died in his hotel suite in 1983, and the coroner's report found that while he was surrounded by booze and prescription drugs, he choked on the cap of his eye drops bottle. Others dispute this and say he died of drug and alcohol abuse. It makes no odds. Whether it was the cork or the contents, the bottle did him in at the end.